Welcome to this Forthright Radio for December 6, 2017. I'm Joy LeClaire. We have a very full show for you today. Our guest is John D. Michaels, and we'll be discussing his book, Constitutional Coup, Privatization's Threat to the American Republic, published by Harvard University Press. Originally, we were going to reach him at his office at UCLA Law School, but because of the fires that continue to erupt in Southern California, he's unable to get there. We'll be asking him about that situation and much more. Professor John D. Michaels' scholarly and teaching interests include constitutional law, administrative law, national security law, the separation of powers, presidential power, regulation, bureaucracy, and privatization. After a very distinguished education, including Oxford and Yale universities, he clerked first for Judge Guido Calabresi of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, and then for Justice David Souter of the U.S. Supreme Court. Immediately prior to his appointment at UCLA, he worked as an associate at Arnold and Porter's National Security Law and Public Policy Group in Washington, D.C. And with that, by way of introduction, we welcome you to Forthright Radio, Professor John D. Michaels.
Thanks so much for having me.
Before we discuss your book, Constitutional Coup, Privatization's Threat to the American Republic, please tell us what you can about the situation down there with all the fires.
I don't want to sound too drastic. The reason why I'm home today in part is because my kid's school has been canceled. So we actually can get around. We live about 2 miles south of the UCLA campus, and the evacuation area is just north of the UCLA campus. But the air quality here is pretty terrible. So I mention that by way of, in case you hear loud children in the background, they are mine. On a more serious note, obviously it's a devastating set of conditions, and not only the homes and the displacement of homes, but you know, some of LA and the world's most cherished institutions are along that corridor that is currently under evacuation, including the Getty Center and the Skirball Center, two just, you know, fantastic museums. So everyone's kind of, you know, holding their breath, hoping for the best.
Well, we certainly are glad to hear that you and your family are, at least for now, safe. I know I speak for many when I say that our hearts go out to everyone down there. We have experienced our own devastations over the years with fires, including my personal loss of my very beloved nephew who was fighting a fires of 2008. He was killed trying to save as much as possible as a firefighter. So the losses are real. Anyway, on with the show. Professor Michaels, your book, Constitutional Coup, Privatization's Threat to the American Republic, is both a history and an analysis of privatization and the rise of what you call Pax Administrativa. Just yesterday, The Intercept published a report entitled Trump White House Weighing Plans for Private Spies to Counter Deep State Enemies, from which I quote, "The Trump administration is considering a set of proposals developed by Blackwater founder Eric Prince and a retired CIA officer with assistance from Oliver North, a key figure in the Iran-Contra scandal, to provide CIA Director Mike Pompeo and the White House with a global private spy network that would circumvent official U.S. intelligence agencies, according to several current and former U.S. intelligence officials and others familiar with the proposals. The sources say the plans have been pitched to the White House as a means of countering deep state enemies in the intelligence community seeking to undermine Donald Trump's presidency." Quote, "Pompeo can't trust the CIA bureaucracy, so we need to create this thing that reports just directly to him. It is a direct action arm, totally off the books. The whole point is, this is supposed to report to the president and Pompeo directly." And this was being quoted from a former senior U.S. intelligence official with firsthand knowledge of the proposals in describing the White House discussions. That's the end of the quote from The Intercept. Now, a dominant thesis of your book is that the administrative state replicates the separation of powers of the Constitution. Explain what you mean by that. What are these powers that are separate in the administrative state? And doesn't this news indicate it's being undermined?
Yes, absolutely. And I read the Intercept report with some alarm. And I have to say, in writing my book and in studying privatization for the better part of a decade, nothing kind of clued me in or prepared me for what I read by Matthew Cole and Jeremy Scahill about this proposal by the combination of, it looks like Eric Prince is involved, the former head of Blackwater, and Oliver North may be involved as well. So I just want to be clear before we kind of dig into the details either of this proposal or my book, that this current proposal, if accurately reported or characterized, I should say, represents yet a further kind of departure from kind of our public norms, our public traditions, and our kind of sense of who we are and our understandings of loyalty and disloyalty and everything else that's kind of been thrown up into the air in the last year. So I do want to kind of mark that this is just not another run-of-the-mill privatization adventure. And by the way, I think most of the run-of-the-mill ones are deeply problematic, and this represents a further kind of departure.
One of the questions that you're addressing is the administrative state, in other words, like all the different agencies that have arisen over the last century or so, are they constitutional? They actually replicate the design, the architecture of the Constitution in that they have separation of powers. Talk about what you mean by that in terms of the agencies involved.
One way to think about the administrative state, and by the administrative state, just for those who aren't as familiar with the term, essentially we're talking about all the federal agencies. It's the Department of Justice, it's Health and Human Services, it's Housing and Urban Development, it's the Department of Transportation, it's the Environmental Protection Agency. More often than not, if you're dealing with the government, whether it's the local, state or federal level, you're probably dealing with an administrative agency. And for many of us, we just kind of take that for granted that they're kind of staple features. They're staples of our modern state, just like they're staple features of almost every other state in the world. What happened when we developed these in the progressive era and then really ramped up in the period spanning the New Deal and World War II is that folks got a little bit concerned. And one of the more trenchant was, hey, we have this system that the framers put together that's predicated on the separation of powers, and that federal power is disaggregated, it's triangulated among three sets of institutions. This is the familiar separation of powers that we all learn in school, that Congress makes the laws, the executive branch enforces the laws, and the judges interpret the laws. And these are separate bodies, and they're meant to be pitted against each other and to be rivalrous and to check and balance each other. What agencies did, however you want to put it, the genius or the destructiveness of agencies, is that they combine these disaggregated powers under one roof. So agencies have the power to make rules that are generally applicable and that carry with them the force of law. So the EPA promulgates a new rule about kind of emission standards that binds us in the same way that congressional laws do. Then the agency has the power to enforce those, which is, again, the core executive responsibility to say, hey, you guys are emitting too much pollution. You're not doing the right type of safeguards, or you're not treating the miners in the mine shaft properly. Most of them have adjudicatory bodies within the agency that essentially hear the grievances and adjudicate on them, like a mini court. And so folks got very concerned and said, look, we have a system that's all about checking and balancing power, and now you've consolidated these authorities under one roof. And that's a serious challenge to our understandings of liberty, which again is predicated on the checks and balances. Where I come in on this story is say, well, not so fast. If you actually peer into this black box of administrative agencies, the power within these agencies is once again disaggregated. It's not disaggregated in the kind of traditional three branches of government way, but we have three sets of rival stakeholders that are meaningful participants within the administrative state, and they're rivalrous with one another. And specifically, those three are as follows. The ones that perhaps folks are most familiar with are the political agency heads. They're the ones that the president appoints to run the agency. So these are folks that are in the news. So you referenced the CIA director. It's Ryan Zinke, who's been in the news a lot as a Secretary of Interior. We have Scott Pruitt is the head of the EPA. You know, under different administrations, we've had obviously different folks heading these offices. But they represent basically the president's interest within the administrative state. And kind of pitted against them, as the way at least I see it, are the civil servants. And the civil servants are career folks. They're not appointed by the president. They're not subject to presidential removal. Generally speaking, and historically this is born truth, is that they stay from administration to administration. So they serve under Democrats, they serve under Republicans, and they kind of, you know, they build up careers, they build up expertise, and they carry out a lot of the day-to-day work. The third set of participants in my administrative separation of powers is all of us. Under the Administrative Procedure Act, which is a landmark federal statute that lays out a lot of the terms for how agencies are supposed to run, the public has a great deal of access and input on administrative decision-making. And the way I see things, so once you look inside and recognize the administrative agencies are not monolithic, but they're made up of these groups that are potentially quite rivalrous, that represent different interests, that have different accountability bases, are diverse in different ways, that have different perspectives, that we see this kind of rivalrous government that James Madison really wanted us to have. And we've kind of refashioned it to make it work within the demands of modernity, which needs a lot of expert agencies to handle all the problems that have arisen or that we've newly recognized as worthy of kind of public attention and public resources. So for me, what I do say to the folks who say the administrative state is a kind of violation or a troublesome departure from the framer system is not so fast. Take a look, and we've actually seen a functional reproduction of the checks and balances.
We have an extremely activist community in Mendocino County. Many of us will remember the hearings on the coast decades ago when there was proposed testing to ascertain oil or whatever underneath the waters off our coast. And we were able to turn that back, and that was in the Reagan administration, where the forces seemed to be mightily aligned against the wishes of the people. Of course, not every story is successful, but it really does amplify what you're saying about the separation of powers, that they are rivalrous, at times antagonistic, and they can effectively create checks and balances.
One quick point on that, the dangers of privatization is that it eliminates a lot of these opportunities for checking and balancing because public access is constrained when you're dealing with corporations as opposed to public agencies. Public participation to be meaningful in order not just for my theory to work, but also for our government to function quite well and in the ways that you've suggested that at least at times we've seen, you know, dramatic, regardless of what we think about the politics of the particular decisions, public input is invaluable.
Let's back way back. When we're speaking of privatization, we think of it as a relatively new phenomenon, but actually it's not. There was a whole era of privatization even before we became a country. In fact, without privatization, we might not have won the American Revolution. Would you briefly remind us of some of that history?
It's interesting whether, you know, terminology here matters because it's almost like a chicken and an egg problem. In some ways, it wasn't privatization in the past. It was simply that the government was so small that private actors had to carry out a lot of functions that today we would think are entirely functions that are deservingly the responsibility of the government. Private jails, for instance, you know, before we had a regulatory system to protect consumers and workers, we relied simply on tort law to do so, just law, private lawsuits. But to your particular point, at the founding, there was a deep distrust of standing armies in America. And that makes sense because of our very recent and troubled history with British troops, occupying troops, forcibly quartering themselves in the houses of colonialists and taking, you know, advantage of the citizenry. So we're deeply distrustful of a standing army, and we also were concerned about developing just a military class at all, because historically it's been, you know, military groups that have engineered, taken over the reins of government. So what we did in our, even in our Constitution, we actually have a provision that allows for Congress to call forth what are called letters of marque and reprisal, which essentially allowed for privateers, people who had commercial ships, to essentially aid in various kind of military operations, to seize other ships and whatnot. And that was a way in which the government had the capacity to remain small, but yet leverage the kind of private sector forces. And in some ways, we're still dealing with that history because it informs our understanding of two things. One is the relative balance between the market and the state in our society is not the same balance that's struck in other places, particularly places like, you know, historically in Europe, where we've seen much larger states and much less kind of concern about state overreach into regulatory domains. Whereas here, the private sector has always been kind of the dominant sector, as it were. And a lot of times when government tries to enter into new regulatory spaces, there's a lot of concerns about it being encroachments on liberty. So that history we have to take very seriously. What I would say about that, though, is that in the 1930s, particularly, again, this New Deal period is, in to me, is in some ways the most momentous one, the most revealing one, we kind of flipped the script. It actually goes back a little earlier into the Progressive Era. Everything kind of changed. The government became much more responsive, much more kind of politically sensitive to the challenges, particularly at that moment of economic dislocation. And over time, especially in the 60s and the 70s, became much more sensitive to the disenfranchisement and the disempowerment of women, people of color, and that the public sector really became a much more responsive space than it had ever been, certainly prior to the Civil War. So in the old days, the really old days, the difference between public and private provision didn't really matter so much because the average American was politically disenfranchised anyway. It wasn't that consequential if you were housed in a private jail as opposed to a, you know, municipal jail. Either way, that person probably had very few means of influencing either the private jailer or the, you know, the city government, as it were. But today, that difference matters a whole lot. Private companies are not responsive to those types of interests, but the public sector, as much as we might gripe about its lack of responsiveness, is still considerably more responsive to needs, demands, and grievances of average folks. And that's why I think that space has become so much more important and why we can't just say it's a coin flip between public and private provision of services. Whereas in you know, 1791 or 1815, that difference really wasn't a very consequential one.
Just as an aside, I refer our listeners to the show I did earlier in the year with William Hoagland about his book, The Autumn of the Black Snake, The Creation of the U.S. Army and the Invasion that Opened the West. It talks about the consolidation of political power and particularly the role of George Washington and his allies to create a standing army, which, as you pointed out, was something a lot of people were resistant to. Back to the story at hand here. You make some very important points in your book about the evolution of the different agencies, and particularly how important it is that civil servants, bureaucrats, who have really been defamed in many ways over the past decades, why their protections are actually protections for all of us. Could you go into that?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. And I'm also particularly glad that you mentioned that the kind of challenges they're facing today, and that as much as we see, and at least many of us are alarmed by the kind of the verbal attacks that are being leveled against civil servants. These are just, you know, folks from various communities who work for the government and devoted their careers to the government, that this is not a purely Trump phenomenon, but that this has been a kind of, in some ways, a slow boil. And it's been a long time coming where it's been a kind of American pastime to lambaste civil servants as lethargic, as torpid, as unimaginative, uncreative. And now today it's taken kind of a darker turn where there's questions about they're disloyal. So I just wanted to kind of note that and note how challenging that is for a number of reasons. One, it undermines the legitimacy of their actions. Two, it demoralizes the folks working there, and the most talented are leaving because they don't want to put up with it anymore, understandably. And it becomes kind of a self-fulfilling cycle that the civil service is called debased, and lo and behold, it becomes debased because no one values it, and it becomes a less desirable place to work, and it loses the respectability of the public. This is essential to recognize the role that the civil service plays in our system, not just in our everyday lives, but for me, it has constitutional salience for the reasons of it's a necessary predicate to the what I call the administrative separation of powers. Why we want civil servants to have political protections from being fired because of a disagreement with the current head of the agency or with the president is because we want experts to be able to speak essentially truth to power. The civil servant's calling card is their expertise. It is their command of the subject matter over which they're working. It is their years of experience across multiple administrations that have different political objectives. You know, you referenced earlier the Reagan administration. Under the Reagan administration, there was a huge call for deregulation. In some ways, a more kind of conceptually clear call for deregulation than the one we're witnessing today. There weren't these challenges that civil servants were disloyal. There was just honest disagreements about what kind of state we wanted to have and how protective or how limited it was going to be. If we take away the protections of the civil service to say, you know, hey, boss, I understand that's what plays in the opinion polls, but the science doesn't bear that out. Or the statute that Congress authorizes us to proceed according to doesn't allow us that degree of discretion. We want civil servants to have that space. We want there to be contention and the political leadership, because otherwise affirms the fears that the administrative state is entirely driven by the politics of the moment, by whoever's president. The civil servants are counterbalance on the kind of political moment that we find ourselves in. And that's important under Republicans, and it's important under Democrats. Because if you think about our presidential system, most of the time presidents win, you know, a big victory for a president is like 55% of the vote. We don't have a system where then the president gets to reshape the administrative state for the next 4, possibly 8 years on the basis of a pretty slim mandate. We have a system just like our constitutional system where the president has to work with other stakeholders to achieve objectives. And the civil servants, to me, provide that grounding, that stability to say, yeah, you won the election, but you didn't win in a landslide, and you need to take into consideration all the things we have been doing, and we're not going to switch on a dime. And I think that's totally fine. This is not an anti-Trump book per se. I wrote this book fully expecting Secretary of State Hillary Clinton to win. I wrote my concerns about runaway executive power throughout the Obama administration. I think this is a theory that works cross-partisan lines. It happens to have come out now at a moment in which people are paying much closer attention to the kind of demoralization and the attacks on the civil service. But this is all bipartisan stuff or nonpartisan stuff.
This is certainly a nonpartisan show as well, and always has been. I just want to also reference the show we did in October with Joel Clement, who was a policy director, so he was very high up in the Department of Interior, was involuntarily reassigned from a top climate science policy position to what was essentially an accounting job at the Department of Interior. And he finally resigned after initially saying that he wasn't going to, he just couldn't take it anymore, and decided that he could be more effective outside of the agency than inside of the agency. Now, let's get back to some of the other benefits to the public. Aside from the specific things that any particular agency does, you mentioned the act, the APA.
Yeah, the Administrative Procedure Act.
That requires a certain level of transparency, which seems that the private sphere, it doesn't apply to them. It's like the Administrative Procedures Act simply doesn't apply to the privatized sphere. Am I right about that?
Largely. And again, this is what folks say, oh, the administrative state is Who are these unelected bureaucrats? Who's running the country? Who's doing all these things behind closed doors? Well, if you take a look, especially if you look at the way the Administrative Procedure Act is laid out, it is creating a democratic forum for regulatory governance. Agencies proceed most recognizably is through something called informal rulemaking, which is really not that informal at all. It's the label it's kind of acquired over time. But it requires that the agency is thinking about making a rule. It has to give a heads up. It has to publish that heads up so they have a notice. And then notice has to be pretty clear. Then there's space for an open comment period where you submit your take. I think we should have this, or I think this is a dangerous pattern to go down for the following reasons. The agency has to sit down and take seriously those comments. Because if they don't, and they go ahead and they promulgate a rule that doesn't take those seriously, you can go to the courts and say, hey, that was arbitrary. That was capricious of them to proceed notwithstanding the concerns I'm voicing here or the concerns I articulated in my memorandum. Or, you know, a lot of this stuff is done by pretty sophisticated research groups or public interest groups or corporate interest groups. So these are, you know, often thorough reports. But at the same time, the agencies take very seriously the comments from people who are just have a, you know, a vested interest or have a particular insight onto a question who may not claim, you know, having a PhD on the subject or may not, you know, specially bind his or her report into a, you know, a glossy portfolio. So what we see in this space, this rulemaking space, is an opportunity for public engagement, for political involvement, because the agency heads kind of set the agenda. But again, expertise matters. The civil servants who are shaping these rules, who are looking at these comments and say, oh, we have to take this comment pretty seriously. Maybe we need to do a little bit more research on this. What we see in this space is interplay of pure politics and kind of populist interest. And I mean populist in the broadest sense, just people off the streets who want to weigh in. The third prong, the civil servant and their professional expertise. And they're all working together. And the Administrative Procedure Act, in some ways, creates the space for this to happen. It's not an act of raw politics. It's not an act of unelected bureaucrats going off into a dark alley, formulating policy that has no political insight or no public engagement. It puts it all together. And that's what I think is so special about this space, and why I'm concerned that the more we privatize, the more we push things out of public corridors, out of, as you framed it, transparent spaces, and also, for me, open access spaces, and put them into conduits of private power where we're not guaranteed that access or that transparency. We're not even guaranteed that things will be fashioned as rules. When decision-making is handed off to private parties, they may act pursuant to their own operating protocols, and public access to that might be quite limited. They might not be open to public participation for any number of reasons. They may simply say, because we're trying to protect our intellectual property, and if we give this away, then we lose our competitive balance. So there might be, you know, basically reasonable arguments for businesses not to be as transparent as government. But that should give us a reason to pause before we hand over the reins of government to these private actors.
Professor Michaels, I was shocked when, in your book, you talked about the impossibility of even being able to gauge how much privatization has happened and is happening. Will you talk about it, just in terms of getting a sense of how much money is being privatized, much less the work itself? Talk about that, please.
It's really kind of stunning. We don't have a set database where someone can just quickly look on his or her laptop and say, oh, yeah, we have this number of contractors, and they're doing these types of jobs, and the bill every year is this you know, gigantic number. We don't have that. So what we have are people scrambling to try to make the best guesses of size, approximations. And there's a political scientist at NYU who's probably the most diligent and, I guess, successful census taker of the world of the privatized federal workforce. But he's got to do a lot of kind of problem solving and detective work to figure this stuff out. Perhaps the most galling or troubling moment that really in some ways sparked a lot of my interest was in the early days of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. when it was brought to light some of the problematic behavior of some of the private military contractors, there was a hearing before the Senate. And the Senate had brought in a number of the heads of the Defense Department, generals with the very heavily decorated. You can see their uniforms are just kind of festooned with all their ribbons. And John McCain was asking them, well, what's the number? How many people do we have there? And there's a pause, and you see the Pentagon officials and the generals and the admirals conferring for a second, and they say, we're going to have to get back to you. And McCain looked shocked. You mean to tell me you don't know how many people are there? And, of course, we can rattle off exactly how many uniformed service personnel are there. That stuff is very meticulously kept. And this idea that we're sending private actors into war zones and we don't know how many are there or exactly what their responsibilities are doing, it just goes to show that we certainly aren't keeping tabs of, you know, every single Department of Energy contract or subcontract that's out there. And it's quite galling. Now, my concerns aren't, though, there's no reason why they shouldn't be, but my concerns aren't primarily fiscal ones. There are plenty of people who object to privatization on fiscal accountability grounds, full stop. And for those people, this is enough to send them into a fit, because if the entire purpose of contracting, as it often is stated to be, is all about making government more efficient, all about saving money, well, the contracting out initiative at the federal level has failed on the macro level. At that level, we don't need to get into all the kind of normative and constitutional issues, the philosophical questions that kind of most animate me. Right there alone, the fact that we don't have a clear account of us operate better is a huge red flag.
The ability to account for expenditures really should be a given, and it is not.
Yes.
Now, there's so many places we could go in the time we have left, but I want to use another recent example, and this is from an essay that you published, co-written with University of Colorado Law School Professor Frederick Bloom, entitled First Tragedy, Now Farce. I'm going to quote briefly from it. It's no accident that FBI directors have a statutory term of 10 years, not 4 or 6 or even 8. It's no accident either that FBI directors have long been treated as quasi-independent officials, empowered differently than most other political appointees, and not generally thought of as serving only at the pleasure of the president. The end of quote. This was in reference to the firing of former FBI Director James Comey. Now, many people have compared that situation to the one in the Nixon administration when he fired the special prosecutor Archibald Cox. And you and your co-author beg to differ with that as a very perfect analogy. Could you please talk about that situation, how it differs, and why it matters?
The firing of Jim Comey, one of the chief concerns among many, in some ways the quote lays out the concerns that we don't want to politicize the FBI under any grounds, even if they're not engaging in investigations of the White House. Most of the time they're not. And we still want this independence. And one of the reasons why we insist on this independence, we don't want the president essentially dictating the criminal law enforcement priorities, because there's always a fear of politics getting in the way, whether it's partisan politics or simply what seems like red meat for the masses, like recently President Trump's, I believe they were tweets or public statements, essentially saying the individual who ran his car through the pedestrians in New York should be sent to Guantanamo or something along those lines. We get very uncomfortable with moves of that sort. And one of the ways to insulate the FBI director, to allow the FBI to kind of focus on its priorities, and also just more broadly, the community of U.S. attorneys, is to keep politics as best we can out of the law enforcement realm, because it's just a dangerous, you know, I know it's a slippery slope. It's just, it lends itself to all sorts of problems and distorted or selective prosecutions. So on a broader scale, I'm deeply concerned about the politicization of the FBI. And recently, just to stay on this thread, the president has questioned where the Justice Department is on Secretary Clinton's emails in the midst of all these investigations of him and people are part of his campaign and White House surrogates. The president has taken the initiative in once again challenging the Justice Department and questioning its integrity and priorities. And if you didn't believe in the past that we needed to have such a strict kind of insulation of the Federal Bureau of Investigations from the president, I would imagine that today people would feel a little bit differently, because clearly there's a great danger in constantly waging war with the Justice Department. It enables the folks who are thinking that the FBI is illegitimate to maybe perhaps not comply as much, or simply to discredit what they're doing, or to fuel conspiracy theories about quote-unquote a deep state. All of these things are dangerous, and they are just words, but the words have power to them, and they change perceptions. And I think we need to be vigilant about allowing that type of casual remarks that discredit government officials, that discredit judges, that discredit journalists. I think we have to be very careful about how we do that. And that, among other things, strikes me as a reason why this moment might be a little bit different from previous moments.
To follow along with that thought, I can't recall a time in which the heads of the various agencies, so many of them, are outspoken and well-known antagonists to the very purpose and mission of the agencies they have been appointed and confirmed to head. As an example, one of EPA Director Scott Pruitt's very first things to do was to spend $25,000 to create a room that would be completely immune to any ears other than the ones that he chose, including everybody in his agency, the Environmental Protection Agency. And we won't even get to his opinions about the scientists and that sort of thing. But is there anything in the APA or any other legislation that would prevent this sort of action?
So first of all, yes, I agree with you completely. We see this with Rick Perry in the Department of Energy. We see it in some degree with Rex Tillerson in the State Department. We see it with Ryan Zinke in the Department of Interior. This is largely a set of cabinet officials who don't necessarily believe in the central missions of the agencies they're charged with running. Ultimately, who's to blame for this? Well, some of it obviously lies at the feet of the American public for choices we've made at various moments in terms of who we've voted for president, for the Senate, and whatnot. The Senate, though, is the other main players in this. The Senate has to confirm each of these folks, and the Senate has confirmed all of them. No one has been surprised that Scott Pruitt is hostile to the EPA. That's largely what's his calling card. Ryan Zinke in the Department of Interior, he's very distrustful of a large federal presence on the lands of America. He's distrustful of it. Rex Tillerson, he's not distrustful of diplomacy per se. He clearly doesn't seem to have much value for the officials working in his building. The Senate has some responsibility, and this is a larger conversation about congressional abdication of authority, which is not a new phenomenon. But the Senate's job in providing what the Constitution calls advice and consent is to make sure that every individual that the president puts forward for positions of, I think as you put it, for the highest ranking positions in the executive branch are up to the task. And up to the task is not just about basic qualifications, but also what their outlook is. And this, again, is not a pure partisan issue. This is about whether you just believe in the mission, though you can believe in the mission of an agency and have different views about where to devote resources, whether you're going to take the State Department more of a hawkish stance towards other nations. But I am shocked, I'm alarmed by the degree to which we now have a number of high-ranking officials who really don't believe in the missions of the agencies. There's nothing about the APA that can help us there. This is entirely a kind of a political and to some degree a cultural phenomenon.
Well, I'm so sorry, and I deeply regret to say we have run out of time. Professor John D. Michaels, thank you so much for your work and joining us today, and I do hope you and your family stay safe down there.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I apologize for the poor connection at times. I'm sorry about that.
Well, you know, we work with what we have. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Our guest today on Forthright Radio has been Professor John Michaels of UCLA Law School. We have been discussing his book, Constitutional Coup, Privatization's Threat to the American Republic, published by Harvard University Press. The views and opinions expressed on Forthright Radio are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of KZYX and Z staff, its members, board of directors, or contributors. Forthright Radio is a Beyond the Deep End production broadcast each first and third Wednesday of the month from the Philo Studios of KZYX and Z, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. Engineer, Rich Culbertson. I'm Joy LaClaire.